The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I think the message is China is in your face. I had a hard time. I think I'd be a lousy teacher. I once thought about it, but I didn't qualify. Nobody wanted to hire me as a teacher in America because I just get upset when I see kids taking this country for granted. I just go pretty nasty. So now I get a little bit good time. I said, my first question, I said, in the high school, I say, how many of you know China is the number one debt holder of the United States? How many of you are happy with that? No hands. How many of you know the source of why China fear the West, especially America? Do you know, any of you know, the Opium War, 1840 and 1860, Emperor of China lost in both wars and kept resisting until 1900, that as a result, 13 nations invaded China to force opium to the throat of Chinese and succeeded. And then, of course, my generation, we were raised anti-American because America was in Vietnam and China was going to be next. That's how we were raised to believe. Before I was taught to write my own name, I was taught to write, "I love you, Chairman Mao. I love you, Communist Party of China." Never, "I love you, Mama," or "I love you, Papa." My first encounter with Pro of China, Pro Buck, was during the Cultural Revolution. I was a teen and going to school at Shanghai Middle School, and I was told by the principal to write a composition criticizing American novelist Pro Buck as a cultural imperialist. It took me a long time to understand that term. I actually didn't understand, but I had to do my task. My only regret was that I was not given a chance to read The Good Earth because I wanted to, so I at least know what I was criticizing about. But of course, her book was, The Good Earth, was considered too toxic to even to be translated. So what do? The principal said, just do the usual, which is copy from a newspaper. No, I did not know. 1971, Henry Kissinger and Premier Zhou Enlai was making connections for Nixon's historical visit to China to open the door, 1972. So Pearl Buck was scheduled to be on Nixon's board as the Nobel Prize winning novelist, the journalist for the delegation, and most importantly, the translator, standing in between Mao and Nixon. And Madam Mao would never let Pro Buck get that chance, the camera time, because Madam Mao was preparing to take over China, to be China's next president after Mao. And she wanted to show the world's media that it's not just her and Mao who did not like Pearl Buck, it's the Chinese people. So she started this campaign, ordering children all over China to write criticisms so she can show to the world's media that it's our children too. And did not like her. I was one of the children. And it never occurred to my mind that I did anything wrong. I was just so proud to defend my country. So my next encounter with the name of Probuck was in 1996. I was in a Chicago bookstore reading from my memoir, Red Azalea. Afterwards, a lady came and asked me, she says, "Aunt Chimin, do you know Prolas Buck?" Before I could answer the question, she says, "I want you to know, Prolas Buck taught me to love Chinese people." "Love Chinese people?" And she says, "Here, it's a book, it's a paperback, my gift to you. It's A Good Earth." So I went back to the hotel, start reading, and finished the book on the plane from Chicago to Los Angeles. I couldn't help myself but broke down and sobbed. I realized how wrong I was. I have never read any novelist, including my favorite, most respected Chinese novelist, who wrote about our peasants the way Probuck did, with such admiration, affection, and humanity. So it was at that very moment the idea for a book, Pro of China, was born. I was determined to celebrate Probuck's life and to show Probuck's role in the history of China, and also to show the role of friendship played in surviving unspeakable hardship. I was amazed during my research, all these years, during this time of denunciation, Probuck must be aware of that, because you see, 1972, Nixon visited China, and 1973, Probuck died of heartache, heartbroken, because she was rejected the visa to ever visit China. And you know how stress can do to a person. Yet, through all her writings, she never lost her love and faith in Chinese people, and vice versa. During my research, I found that Chinese people never lost their faith and love in Prolas Buck. That's why I decided to write my book from a Chinese perspective. So I choose to write from a combine a several actual friends of Probuck and into this character, Willow. I'm going to read you the opening paragraph of my book. "Before I was Willow, I was Weed. My grandmother Nai Nai insisted that naming me Weed was better. She believed that the gods would have a hard time making my life go lower if I was already at the bottom. Papa disagreed. Men wanted to marry flowers, not weeds. They argued and finally settled for Willow, which was considered gentle enough to weep and tough enough to be made into farming tools." My writing is very much influenced by Chinese ancient, especially classic ancient Tang Dynasty poems and Song Dynasty verses and classic novels. And I share that with Probuck. I just find out that she wrote in English, but her thinking was in Chinese. And the beauty of Probuck's writing, and it shows the Chinese way of telling stories, and I follow the same tradition. I wonder if any of you know anything. Well, never mind. The answer is no, because I don't think Probuck would ever be able to share with of you on how she was raised to, for example, recite the Chinese poems. I'm tempted to show you how the sound should be like when Probuck is taught by, because, you know, her tutor, Mr. Kong, was her tutor. Let me quote her own words. Probuck said, and I quoted her, I love this. Probuck said, "I belong to China, for I have lived there from childhood to adulthood. Happy for me that for instead of the narrow and conventional life of the white man in Asia, I lived with the Chinese people and spoke their tongue before I spoke my own, and their children were my first friends." So I was thinking about this. I imagine little Pro reciting Chinese Confucius poems. And it's the base of Chinese culture. Even the poems that I was taught, mainly is Mao, composed by Mao, and Mao stole or influenced by Tang Dynasty, Song Dynasty poems. So I'm going to share with you this one. It's called, I think you might like it, because it's called Praising the Winter Flower. It's Mao's picture. He copied this poem from Tang Dynasty and used it to portray himself and Communist Party of China. That's right before his winning of the China 1949. He called himself this little flower and blossoming in the middle of the winter on the high cliffs, on the ice cliffs. And he says, "I'm not here to compete with the spring. I'm here to announce the arriving of the spring." And by the time the mountains, the blossom all over the mountain, I will be hiding among the flowers and smiling in delight. And that's very much a Chinese philosophy about the person, the individual's role in life. So I'm going to do it in Chinese.
Feng Yu, Song Chun Gui. Fei Xue, Ying Chun Dao. Yi Shi Xuan Ya, Bai Zhang Bing. Yu Yu, Hua Zhi Qiao. 俏也不争春，只把春来报，带到山花烂漫时，他在丛中笑。
So I figure why I learned that from Probuck's daughter that she was. Part of her was very lonely, especially in her later years when she was reaching 70 and 80. A lot of things that she can't share with the part of American, and she just have to, you know, keep it to herself. And that's why she's dreaming. She's standing in her Chinese robe in her window at her home, very close to here, in this floral Chinese dress before her days before her death. And the last images on her mind was China. And I think probably it's her childhood, the children she played. So I'm going to read you a paragraph on Willow and Pearl as children. Later, Pearl told me that she didn't like what her father said, although she was happy that the trick worked. "I'm sure your father loves you," I comforted my friend. Pearl shook her head. "To tell you the truth, I'm jealous of those whom he baptizes. He offers affection to strangers, to you, to Nai Nai, to your papa, Carpenter Chang, Lilac, and almost everyone in town. He will never spare affection for his own children. He's always cold with me." "Absalom loves you, Pro." "I don't feel it. My mother doesn't feel his love either. Absalom shuts himself in the study so that he can be with God without any distraction." "Your father is proud of you, Pro, or he wouldn't say that you were a good Christian." "Absalom cares about Chinese people so much that he's willing to risk his life for them. In the meantime, he believes that they are heathens and he is their superior. He lives to convert people, Willow. He even wants a chance with the warlords. What? Absalom wants to convert Bumpkin Emperor, General Lobster, and General Crab? I laughed. Yes, and their fish wives, shrimp siblings, and snail concubines. That's impossible. Oh, yes, God works miracles, blah, blah, blah. My papa would believe whoever saves his ass. My father is a nut, and your father is a crook. We walked to the outskirts of town where someone was getting married. We joined the children who had been invited to the wedding to help inspire fertility. We were giving nuts and seeds to throw at the new couple. The groom was a young peasant who was already drunk. He meant to thank the guests, but instead he threw up. The bride was dressed in a bright red embroidered costume. Her face was covered with a piece of silk. Pearl and I admired the costume and the bride's glittering hair ornament. When the band started the wedding song, we joined in. Buddha sits on the lotus pet, beautiful fingers, orchid light, sun goes down and moon comes up. May your life be peaceful and tranquil. Mud walls and straw pillows, food, seeds, and many suns, happiness and longevity. May you have the spring and all its fair weather. I was imagining that Probuck said she loves Chinese peasant operas. Do you know how it sound? Lotus sits on Buddha's pet. 今日同饮请公酒壮志未酬誓不休来日方长写身愁甘洒热血写春秋。Something I like it, and I'm not lonely about that peasant opera. I imagine Probuck, this 10-year-old blonde hair and blue-eyed girl, open her mouth singing things like this. And now, the love affair. This poet's name is Xu Zhimo, and supposedly today still, you can get everything about it. He's been dead for 50 years, but still very hot today. And I found everything about him, this high stack, in the Book City in Shanghai. And in China, critics will tell you that Xu Zhimo is too big for Probuck. And here you will say Probuck is too big for Xu Zhimo, because you never heard of Xu Zhimo. Anyway, the biographers assume that Probuck had his affair with him. I did my research the side way. And I tell you, this is Xu Zhimo. This guy is a poet and a literary giant. And he was educated in Oxford. And he had a degree in Columbia University in New York. So he came back to China. He wanted to promote the new literature. Because in China, the language is for the imperial class. For example, emperor owns his own language. Nobody understands. It's so privileged. So the peasants would not be able to read. Reading is something you have to be educated to do. So Xu Zhimo's goal when he come back to China is to make the language peasant-friendly. So he was pushed, and he was on this frontier, and all the, including all this women's liberation, and he once wrote a essay on women's suicide, because in China, when a woman committed suicide, she's honored. And Xu Zhimo says, well, I like the Western idea, this individual, the life is precious to her. And she should not die just to honor the ancestor or to honor this dead husband. So Xu Zhimo is very popular among young women. And my research went through the influence that Xu Zhimo tried to bring to China. He did it slowly. First, he tried to bring this poet from India. Probably many of you know. His name is Tagore. And he is a Nobel Prize, yes, winning poet. Because his writing, Xu Zhimo figured the Chinese would be able to identify a bit easily. So it's like education. Then I found this letter. After Tagore left China, he wrote Xu Zhimo during the correspondence. He says, I didn't have a good time in China. In fact, I had an awful time in China because you stole the show. Now, there wasn't any documents on whether or not Probuck was in the audience listening. Although she invited Xu Zhimo to give a talk in her class afterwards, but the event itself was very well documented. Not only that, there was a picture. Now, picture with these two people on stage. One was Tagore. He's a good-looking man in my eyes, but at the time he had this giant bear and in the shapeless India robe cloth. So the young Chinese female saw this image. They would call him Grandpapa. And the translator, who was Xu Zhimo, standing right next to Tagore, he was dressed so slick in a Western three-piece suit, a tie, and his silky black hair was combed this way. And his look, he was like the Chinese Brad Pitt. There was no evidence that Probuck, you know, was in love with him, but let me quote Pro's word from her own mouth, and you help me judge if she had any thoughts, private thoughts on this man. Probuck said, he used to sit in my living room and talk by the hour and wave his beautiful hands in exquisite and descriptive gestures until when I think of him, I see first his hands. He was a northern Chinese, tall and classically beautiful in looks, and his hands were big and perfectly shaped and smooth as a woman's hands. You read between the lines. So I would like a lot of questions from you. If you can help me, ask me questions. I plan to show you a home video I made because I wanted to bring a treat. Because many of you buy my book from the store, you don't get to see the image of what's going on in Probuck's hometown. And I went 3 months ago and just shoot the video. And also, the video shows the restoration of the town. During the Olympics 2008, the governor in Beijing says, we've got Great Wall. And governor of Xi'an says, we've got the terracotta, the tombs. And the governor of Jiangsu says, we've got Prolus Buck. So he spent all his money. You're going to see how he spent his money in this four-minute video. Now, before the video, questions. Anybody questions? Come on. Yes.
Were you able to go back to China and meet anyone who had known her while she was in China?
Yes. So I'm able to go back and forth in China, freely. My book's banned in China, but I don't make an issue out of it. My father still lives in China, and that's my big concern. China's attitude toward me start to changing, although I am still a controversial figure in China. the attitude change, it's the word I got from the government. It says, we don't have issue with your books. It's just your book have been misused by people whose intention is to demonize China. You can't say that's being untrue. And also, when I went to Zhenjiang for the research, I was not welcome, because people, they were reluctant to talk to strangers. The memory of the Cultural Revolution is still very fresh, and the way they were prosecuted because their relationship with Pro. Although many of them managed to escape by simply denounce Pro's book, but there's one person who's such a good friend, and she loves Pro so much that after Pro left, she changed her name to Pro Yi. And she didn't escape. She had a lot of hard time, barely survived, because the authority says, now how do you explain your name is Pro? You're after your name after Pro Buck. But then the moment I kept returning. The moment they discovered that I was Pro Buck's friend, they started opening up. The first referral I got was from a person says the pastor was ready to see me because he was dying of illness. This is the logic. The pastor thought that now he can afford to tell the truth and be able to get away with the result, with any prosecution. And I had a hard time. I didn't want to steal the dying man's last moment, but he insisted on seeing me. What he loved to talk to me the most was the deeds that's done by Pro Buck's father, Absalom, because this essentially was his church. He's the founding father of that church. So as a researcher, I just took in, I think it was equally as important as how Pro Buck was raised by the parents. And the way of doing the spreading of Christianity was that Absalom had a hard time. He couldn't convert any Chinese. And yet in the meantime, the wife, who did not want to be in China first place, on top of that, she had 4 sons died in China due to all the kind of disease that caught the white children. And she was very resentful. However, she was a Christian and she helped the local people and solved many of their problems. And she refused to accept any good goods to thank you thing. So the Chinese get together, say, she doesn't accept any payment. What should we do? Let's help her by joining her husband's church so the man gets to go to heaven. So that's how it all began. Although they try to give him all the advice, says, you know, your Christ is so miserable. Nobody wanted to worship a person who can't even protect himself. The right way to do it is to first put clothes on Christ and then give him a sword, like a Chinese goddess, you know, Guan Gong, who's have the strong muscles and beautiful metalled costume, the war robe, and a fat belly. But Absalom is very stubborn, and he wouldn't do that. But he had a lot of disciples and who decided to help him anyway. So in his church, you see the picture of Christ that start to look like a Chinese. The eyes goes like, you know. It's the same way when Buddha traveled to China, the Buddha looks like a Chinese. And it later on became the biggest Christian community in China. They're rice Christians. They come to for food. But then during the Cultural Revolution, it became a bond. My personal experience with that was that I was turning into a monster. I was denouncing teachers and being awarded, and I did not know my mother was a secret Christian. I regret it to this day. My mother passed away. I never bothered to ask her Christian background, who converted her, who taught her the values, why she was the way she was. I remember one night during the mid of Cultural Revolution, I got up and stumbled in the dark, a figure that was my mother on her knees. She must be praying. And the other one was after I denounced my teacher who gave me a book, Little Mermaid. I was crying when I was denouncing because, you see, it's a sign to show sacrifice. If I was capable of sacrifice my love for my favorite teacher, then I would be ready to be a martyr, to go to Vietnam, to sacrifice my life for a bigger picture, which was save the poor people in the world, especially the starving children in America. Until I came to this country, I learned that your mother told you to finish your play because children in China are starving. When I brought back the certificate to my mother, it says, Mao's best child, An Chi Minh. I expect my mother to say, I'm so proud of you, and hang the award on the wall. My mother didn't. Instead, she says, An Chi, if you dare to do that again, I will disown you. I thought about reporting my mother, because that sounds very suspicious. It sounds anti-revolution, anti-Mao. But I know my mother's always something not right about her. Later, I learned from my uncle that my mother had a nervous breakdown when she was young. Her family was tried to escape from Japanese. They moved from Shandong province to Shanghai. And then during the trip on the ship, her sister and brother got caught a disease. We call number two disease, probably typhoid. Right. And they were dying. However, the captain on the boat and people on the boat are superstitious. They believe if the children die on the boat, and the boat is going to sink. So it was before their last breath, my mother's sister and brother were thrown into the ocean. So now it makes sense because my mother likes to watch the water, like to be alone, and she would go like this for hours. And once I was a child, I followed my mother, and I was just go behind her like this. I want to see how long it's going to last. And it was me who lost the patient. But my mother, although she's not together, but she rely on her faith. My happiest time with my mother was, I remember, first time seeing my mother like picking me up in daylight. But the background story was, my mother, during the Cultural Revolution, worked as a worker in the rainbow factory. When my father worked in a printing factory. They were former middle school teachers, but to be sent to be reformed. And I was in the kindergarten. It's always at night, dark time. The teacher took me out on the street, says, look, I'm going to abandon you on the street if your mother don't keep, you know, taking advantage of me, not showing up. I have my own four young children to attend. It was always at that devastating moment I looked that way and my mother started showing up and hurrying toward me under the street lamp. And one day I saw my mother in daylight. She came and picked me up at noon. And she was so happy wearing this mask, big mask. She says, oh, my tuberculosis has got so bad, it's contagious. I just got kicked out of the work unit. I'm happy I get to spend time with my kids. And she's happy about, and she started to, one thing odd was she wears black color clothes all the time. So I say, Mom, why are you wearing black color clothes? She said, oh, if I don't wake up tomorrow morning, I will be in the right clothes. And that bothers me because my grandmother, my mother's mother, whom I never met, died at age 49, and my grandfather, age 55, to tuberculosis. But yet I was, you know, happy, try to save the world. Anyway, that's a long answer to your question. Other questions? Yes, please.
What is the name of the town where Pearl Buck lived?
Zhenjiang.
And what province is?
Jiangsu province.
Jiangsu. Yes.
Mm-hmm. It used to be called Qingqiang. Now the spelling, communist spelling, is Zhenjiang. And the other convenience was that one day I was in Zhenjiang in the school doing the film. And all of a sudden, I got a phone call from my father-in-law, my ex-father-in-law, actually. He says, "Where are you?" I said, "I'm at Zhenjiang Middle School." "The Zhenjiang Middle School?" I said, "Yeah, Zhenjiang." He says, "Do you know that Zhenjiang Middle School used to be called the Chongshi Women's School for girls?" And I say, "Well, it's been changing names several times." He said, "But it was a Christian school." I say, "Yes." And I know because Probuck's mother, Carrie, and the Probuck taught in the school. And my father-in-law says, "Do you know your mother-in-law graduated from that school?" I said, "Oh, that was convenient." I said, "I'm coming back. I want all the details." Next question, please. Yes, here. Oh, okay.
And can you tell us how you came to come to America?
It's a long story. And to make it short, how can I possibly make it short? Okay, 1971, Henry Kissinger drew a line. 1972, Nixon. 1973, Probuck died. Then 1974, I was drafted to labor camp. As it's a policy, if a family has four children, two has to be peasants. So I just to be the first. If you don't go, the neighborhood is going to beat the drum in front of the door, humiliate you until you go. And then I was a rice peasant, planting rice in my hands in the manure, and planting rice and cotton. God, I hate to miss all these fun parts. Are you bored?
No.
Okay, maybe I just share with you this. I love this. Do you know the author named Frank McCore? Okay, that's great. I love his book, Angelus Ashes. And the reason I ever bothered to read an English book, I can read a Chinese book one book a day, but read English, it's very hard. All my research, I have to drive myself in a car because English books is a sleeping pill for me. So I can't do it at home, especially not at night. So I do a military style, you know, get up, do my exercise to take care of my old injury, which is spinal cord distortion that left by the labor camp for carrying 200 pounds of manure. And I keep my disc in. And after the exercise, I would drive my car to a public park where there is close to a restroom. So I was sitting in the car to fit 25 minutes of reading when I start get drowsy. And I would come out and do a run to boost my endorphins. And then use the red ladies' room, lots of water, and come do the research. But I found that the Angelus Ashes was really most enjoyable because, you see, I spent 27 years of my life being miserable. And one of the first things I came to America, I found that your magazine, you have girls smiling, this face, that beaming. And you know, this girl never suffered in life. Because the Chinese girls just doesn't have that smile. I can't smile like that. No, I do. So I love the humor. You know, I love Carol Burnett. I love comedy, even Roseanne Barr. Although lots of things they say I don't understand. But with the book, I can check the dictionary. So I fell in love with Angela's Ashes. And I was so thrilled. I was giving a panel with Too Much Pro-Brothers Buck in my mind, Frank McCourt. So that day, he was sitting here. And I was sitting here. In the middle was this lady from Chicago Projects. So the lady began first. She complained about the condition of the projects, and the toilet room was really bad, and she doesn't have enough toilet room. You know, she's a big family and a poor class, and she has to raise 5 kids. She thinks she should have, you know, more bathroom. And the rest I could hardly understand. But then Frank McCourt says, "Oh, don't get me start talking about toilets. I don't have a toilet. When we growing up, we have this bucket." Now, you read the book, you know this bucket placed in the staircase in the corner. So at night, when people go there and do business, he could hear it. And it was stinky. And the whole hallway, and sometimes the stink just come to his room. And he just hated that bucket, but he still had to do business with the bucket. And I said, "Well, you don't start me talking about toilets. I don't even have a bucket." You know, as rice peasants, we don't wear shoes. We don't have toilets or buckets. We just dig a pit and put a board, wooden board on top of it. And because we don't wear shoes, we come up and wet. You got to be careful because it's too narrow. It's a pit. And the problem is that when I do small business, you know what I'm talking about? When I do small business, I can just squat and use my hand to do this chase away the mosquitoes. You don't have no idea what kind of mosquito. They are super mosquitoes. They bit me through my canvas clothes. So I have to do this dance when I'm doing the small business. The problem is when I do the big business. And the big business, because it takes longer time. And the mosquito zillions of mosquitoes, they won't get a chance to bit me. Once the super mosquito bit me, immediately the itch starts. Now, if I hit it, of course I kill the mosquito, but I will lose my balance. And it's a slippery to begin with. If I lose my balance, I will fall down to the pit. Down there is millions of maggots. So I look at Frank McCourt, he look at me, smile, and we discover the project lady disappeared. Now, where was I? What was the question? You can't believe. Remind me, what was the question? How did I come to America? God. Okay. The story is going to grow long and long. You probably missed your car, your train. Anyway. So I was in the labor camp. And hoeing the cotton field, I'm going to really speed. Too bad. You have to probably read my books to find out. No, I'm sorry. This is not in the book. Anyway, I was hoeing the hot cotton field. I did not know. Mao was sick, dying, and Madam Mao was taking over China. That was 1975 and early 1976. And Madam Mao was sending out this talent scout to look for this proletarian peasant face to start her propaganda film to show the nation the woman hero, which is Madam Mao's self-portrait. And I was there, and I was chosen. Now, you probably think it doesn't make sense, right? I made up the story. The thing was, I was hungry that day. Because of my spinal cord injury, I was very slow. And that day, we saw a white van on the edge of the horizon. In the labor camp, we don't see anything, not even a tree. No. And the white van really fancied us, and a group of people came out. They wear green-colored army coats, and we immediately know they're important. So the whole platoon stopped. They watched them, and I thought to myself, I will have my dinner tonight. Because if I didn't finish my quota, I don't get the dinner. So for several days, I've been hungry. So I was working really hard and moving. And from these people's angle, I was the only moving creature on the horizon. That was how I got spotted. And then I got an order. So I was to be put on the tractor and shipped to the Shanghai Film Studio. And it was very much like Miss American pageant. It's just the measurements is different. I had this body solid as a column, and I had a weather-beaten face. And most importantly, the signature of peasant is that I have this colors so thick, it's like a portobello mushroom. So I was a real peasant. And I did not know how to act. I only know how to recite Mao quotations, Mao poems, singing Mao, Madame Mao operas. And they taught me how to act proletarian style. See, okay, Comrade An Chi Minh, let's learn how to drink water correctly. So now, pick up the mug. So I pick the mug, ready, set, start drinking. So I start drinking. And the instructor says, stop. Look at this, little pinky. Miss Bourgeoisie. The correct way to drink water is to grab the mug and gulp it down in one breath and wipe my mouth with both of my sleeves. That's not hard to do because that was what I did in the labor camp as a rice peasant. So I was picked. I was put in front of the camera. I was such a lousy actress. All I could think of is my back, and I don't want to go back to the labor camp. I was so desperate. And then, all of a sudden, during the middle of the production, September 9, 1976, Mao died. October 8th, Madame Mao was arrested. Later on, was sentenced to death. 2 months later, I was denounced as Madame Mao's trash. And for the next 8 years, I tried to kill myself. Didn't succeed. When I come to America, you know, I envy you because you're so lucky. If you wanted to finish yourself, you could just go to your garage and close the door, get into the car. In China, it was so hard to kill yourself. Too many people everywhere. Anyway, for the next 8 years, I was punished the Chinese style. And people, friends, were told not to talk to me. I was toxic. 8 years later, 1984, this one friend who came to America felt she was safe enough to talk to me. How are you, An Chi Minh? She wrote a letter. And I said, I wasn't doing good. I was going to, you know, doesn't make any difference. I'm going to die anyway. And she says, you know, there are options. So I learned that this is a hint. I say, can you help me? She says, I told her, I said, I'm willing to do anything. I'm from the labor camp. If any chance for me to come to America. And she says, well, you don't speak English. I say, I don't. She says, but do you have any talent? I say, I grew up painting Mao murals. So let's apply art school. So I apply an art school in Chicago. And then they sent me I-20. Before that, there's a lot of details. I'm going to fill up the application form, and it's going to go too long because in the application form, the first line is name. And I didn't have American name, English name. And the old gentleman in the neighborhood said, well, you have to have a English name, so Angel. So I wrote down, Angel Min. Now when my daughter, American born, 11 years old, I gave her the paper. I said, look, this is how your mommy came to America. My name was Angel Min. My daughter took the paper, said, Mom, that's Angel Min. And the next line on the application form was sex. I was supposed to circle female. So I consulted my English-Chinese dictionary, 1972 version, the Communist Dictionary. There was no translation for sex. So I did not know whether I'm male or female. So I thought I couldn't go on. So I took the application form to a friend who was a travel guide. And it was 2 o'clock in the morning. She was beat up and working. So she said, okay, let me do it for you. Okay, English language skill. Poor, average, good, excellent. Of course, excellent. And the next tab was passport. I'm going too long. Where's Andy? Okay, thank you. So the passport, I went to the Communist Party secretary. He's the man who didn't know anything but pretend he knew everything. So he saw America, A. So he asked me, is there a difference between America and Albania? It didn't make sense to you, but it makes sense to me. Because the only country that we're friendly with, Albania, North Korea, Vietnam, used to be Russia, but no longer. So I say, yeah, no, there is no difference between America and Albania. Actually, I did not really, I barely know where America was located when I shouted it with, down with American imperialism. Because in our class, the geography, the map was Mao's Long March, the communist map. There isn't nothing about the world map. So after that, the party secretary says, are there proletarians in America? I said, yes, comrade. And he said, do you, Comrade An Chi Min, intend to promote revolution in America? Yes, comrade. Good. We need somebody like you. Stamp, passport. Then I went to American consulate. By then, now you have to be a PhD candidate to be able to get a visa. And that's why my brother and my sister both were rejected American visa because I was here. Stamp called B14, rejection, immigrant tendency. Anyway, I was the first one. I thought to myself, I'm going to write a self-introduction and recite it the same way I recite Mao poems, the way I showed you. And I would not let the consul general interrupt me. If she or he did, going to find out I don't speak English. So when my name was called, I went up there. My name is An Chi Min. I would like to go to America. Really loud, projected my voice. I was shaking. But, you know, I was a lousy actress in front of Madame Mao's camera, but I delivered an Oscar-winning quality performance. So I got this. Okay. I got my visa. And I went to, after that, the consul general just close the curtain. Because in China, they do that. Because if she doesn't close the curtain, the people will see if he's rejected the visa, try to reason and everything. So they have this custom, just talk to you, it's okay or not okay, close the curtain. Then I move to the next window. The Chinese secretary says, huh, you think you fooled consul. You didn't. It's just Americans. They like determined people. So I sound very determined. But I went home. My parents are so scared to even ask whether or not I get the visa. And the moment I told them I got the visa, my mother just collapsed on her knees. So happy she cried. And my father said, you're going to get caught. You're going to get caught. And sure enough. You see, I didn't say goodbye to my family. I wrote 33 letters to family and friends and have my sister hold on to it. I say, you hold on to it until you get a letter from me, from America, say, I arrived and safe. So I left China without saying goodbye. I landed in Seattle. And I'm not going to tell you, but this, oh, it's dragging so long. Okay. When you're nervous, you just wanted to go to the toilet. So I was so nervous, I went to the toilet, and I sit down and discovered in America, airport ladies' room, toilet paper was free, and it's soft and doesn't scratch. All I had packed with me in my suitcase is a toilet paper made of raw straw. Because I thought, you know, I come here to labor, and I got to take care of my period. So I came out of the toilet room and tried to put myself together. And I had the prepared words, whatever happens, I'm going to deal with it. So I come with my passport to the immigration officer. This kind of nice, round-faced guy. Welcome to America. I was so nervous, I didn't understand. I say, thank you. And he says, you are here for college, right? And I say, thank you. And his face grew long. And he opened my passport. And I knew I was in trouble. And I lost it. I couldn't understand anything he said. Everything became sound like... And I bite my teeth. I say, thank you. And he just pointed out the back room where I got, you know, interrogation, deportation. But I'm here today. Well, I might as well finish the story. So the Chinese translator came after 40 minutes. I begged. I say, please give me 3 months. I learned to speak English in 3 months, or I would deport myself. And the Chinese translator talked to me, examined my papers, and I talked to the officer. Eventually, they decided to let me go. So I went to Chicago, signed in with the school, and of course, find out. The foreign student advisor says, you lied, you lied. Look at your application form. You say your English was excellent, but here you don't speak English. I was guilty. I said, thank you, thank you. I said, well, you have to go to the language school, and I was supposed to make it back in 6 months, or the school is bound to report to immigration for my deportation. I bet you will learn to speak Chinese in 6 months if you're as desperate as I was. So I had no sleep. I start learning from Sesame Street, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and Home Depot. That, you know, you go and then buy things and you picture match the words. So I learned my English in 6 months, and then I'm in America. And many years later, it's unreal to me. I'm a best-selling author, writing in English. Well, I think that's all for tonight. And let me show you with the video. And I will sign for you afterwards.
3 years. I wanted to show Hong Kong's character through her relationships with her Chinese friends. I'd invite a number of Pearl's actual friends at different times in her life to create the character rhythm.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.